Good morning. Psalm 131 is one of my favorites of the Psalms of ascents that expresses just a very humble attitude toward God. I'm just a child. Don't give me anything too difficult for me. I just give me what I need. It expresses this this desire to be so dependent upon God, like a child is dependent on the Father. And don't give me things that are too difficult for me to understand. I'm not smart enough for those things. It is with that type of humility, then, that we open up the book of Revelation today and look at some of these symbols and ideas in the book of Revelation, understanding that there are some difficult things in the book of Revelation, and we ought not to become overly dogmatic about our understanding of some of these symbols, but understand that there is a message, a very simple, simple message that we need to understand from this text. We have been taking large steps through the book of Revelation for this year, not every single week. But we've been taking large steps through the book of Revelation. And a couple weeks ago, we had looked at Revelation chapter 13. Just to give just a little bit of background, we have emphasized from the very beginning of the book of Revelation that the book of Revelation is meant to be a warning to Christians in the first centuries about tribulation and persecution that would occur during their lifetime. In fact, the book begins with one of these purpose statements where he says, John writes, he says, "These are things that I'm writing that must soon take place." And he states in verse 3 of chapter 1, "Blessed is he who reads and hears and keeps these words of this prophecy, for the time is near." And so John has the idea that the readers are going to take this and be able to apply them just very immediately, because the symbols and the events that are promised in the book of Revelation were things that were going to take place very soon. In fact, he's going to write about tribulation and persecution. John himself is going through tribulation and persecution. He's writing from the island of Patmos because of the gospel of Christ. Later on in chapter 2, he writes to the church in Pergamum. Jesus speaks to the church in Pergamum, knowing what they are going through. And one of the things they're going through is Antipas, one of the Christians there, has died because of his service, because of his faith. Later on in chapter 6, we see some other persecution that was unleashed upon Christians. And now in chapter 6, we have this visions of souls of saints who have been slain because of the word of God. And they cry out, "How long will you refrain from judging and offending avenging our blood?" The Lord answers, and this is an important idea throughout the book of Revelation. He answers, comforting them and telling them to wait and rest. You're okay, but wait and rest until the number of saints, the rest of the saints, would join them and complete their number. So there's two things that he is telling him to wait for. Jesus says to them, or the Father says to them, or they're given instructions at least, they're given instructions to wait for two things. First of all, they're waiting for vengeance. They're waiting for God to do something. But he says, first, we have to wait for the slaughter of the rest of the Christians, the death of the rest of these Christians. And once that happens, and your number is complete here in paradise, in this place of rest, then vengeance will come. And so there are these two things that we are waiting for, looking for in the book of Revelation. One, the further death of Christians. Two, the vengeance of God upon his enemies. A couple of weeks ago, when we looked at Revelation chapter 13, I think we witnessed one of those. In Revelation chapter 13, the enemies of God are identified particularly. They're identified with minute detail. especially when we looked at Daniel chapter 2 and Daniel chapter 7 and fed that into Revelation chapter 13, letting the Old Testament determine the meaning of, or letting the Old Testament determine the meaning of some of these symbols that are reused in the book of Revelation. We see that Revelation chapter 13, this great sea beast that the devil is using, the dragon is using, well, this sea beast is talking about this the Roman government. And also there is this earth beast in Revelation chapter 13, this false prophet who is associated with the worship of the government or of Caesar himself. And so Christians in Revelation chapter 13 are forced to choose, forced to decide between serving God or bowing to Caesar. Of course, faithful Christians are going to reject worshiping the king. They're going to reject the mark of the beast, as it is called in Revelation 13. Something that identifies someone as a worshiper of the beast, just as God would identify his worshipers with his seal in Revelation chapter 7. The 144,000 are sealed on their foreheads. They're sealed. God knows who are his. Well, those who identify themselves and allow themselves to worship the beast, then that identifies themselves with the beast as well. But the result of faithful Christians are going to reject this worship, the result is not pretty. In fact, in Revelation chapter 13, verse 7, it says that the sea beast made war with the saints and overcame them. What does that imply? It's going to imply some deaths are going to be taking place. A lot of persecution is going to be taking place. In fact, later on in chapter 13, verse 15, it says that it was given to him, talking about this earth beast, this false prophet, this one who is trying to give encouragement to the worship of the first beast. It said it was given to him to give breath to the image of the beast, so that the image of the beast would even speak and cause many as do not worship the image of the beast to be killed. Among other persecutions that it talks about in chapter 13, what's going to happen to people who reject the command to worship the beast? They're going to die. And so in the book of in Revelation chapter 13, I think what we see is part of these items that we are waiting for. God had said, wait until your number is completed. Wait until these other Christians die. And that's what's happening right and left. But here's the wonderful message. We finally went to chapter 14 and saw what happens to these Christians who die. We look at this and we tear out our hair and we say, well, what's going on? Where is God? Why is God allowing this to happen? But then chapter 14 begins to answer these questions. While this death of saints troubles us, and indeed it troubles God as well, but In chapter 14, God opens the curtain and lets us see the status of these dead saints. It says in chapter 14, verse 1, then I looked, and behold, the Lamb was standing on Mount Zion. Behold, with him, 144,000, having his name and the name of his Father written on their foreheads. And what are they doing? Are they suffering? No, they are singing and glorifying God, how great he is, because they are the ones, in verse 4, who have been purchased among men as first fruits to God and to the Lamb. They are blessed. They are fine. They are at rest. They are dead physically, but they are alive spiritually. That's hard to wrap our minds around, isn't it? That's really hard for us to consider, that what we see right now, this is not our full existence. This is not the real reality, but this is just the staging area for us then to go on to something even more real and something even more glorious. But now that we have met this moment of seeing the number of the Christians completing the number of those souls who are underneath the altar, what's the other thing that we're waiting for? Well, God's vengeance to come upon the enemies of God. And that's what we're going to have in chapter 14. So in chapter 13, we have the heyday for the different beasts. They are on top of the world. They get to do whatever they want. It is given to them this, and it's given to them this, and it's given to them all these different... And they enjoy it, and they kill off the saints. But now it's God's turn. in chapter 14. And we are going to see God coming in great wrath and great action and vengeance because of what his enemies have done against his saints. It begins in chapter 14 with announcements. So in chapter 14, verse 6, we have announcements given by several angels. It says in verse 6, "Now I saw an angel flying in mid-heaven, having an eternal gospel to proclaim to those who inhabit the earth, and to every nation and tribe and tongue and people. And he said with a loud voice, 'Fear God and give him glory, because the hour of his judgment has come. Worship him who has made the heaven and the earth and the sea and the springs of waters.'" This is really amazing. The first message that God gives to this people is not, "You are dead." This is just amazing, the grace of God. That even though these are the individuals that have killed his people, how does he start the conversation? Fear God. Extending the hand still. Asking them to fear God, he who has made the heavens and the earth and the sea and the springs and the waters. He starts off with the gospel. He starts off with good news. We need to be amazed by God's love and God's mercy. We have noticed this on several occasions, that the punishments that God gives in the book of Revelation, even though they are so devastating sometimes, they are limited. God is not showing all of his power that he could. If God showed all of his power, then the whole earth would be destroyed, right? But he shows his limited power, his limited punishment against, for what purpose? Lord, why don't you just do something and completely just finish the story? Because God is patient, waiting for men to repent. And with each punishment he gives, it is another opportunity for men to reassess their lives. It's a good lesson for us as well. God is giving us time to repent. God is giving us opportunities every day to turn our lives around. Are we listening? The second angel speaks in verse 8, chapter 14, verse 8. Another angel, a second one, following, saying, "Fallen, fallen is Babylon the Great, she who has made all the nations drink of the wine of the wrath of her sexual immorality." So here's the second angel and comes announcing something about Babylon. Then we start scratching our heads. Why is he talking about Babylon? I thought Babylon was in the Old Testament, wasn't that? We talked about the Babylonian captivity, Nebuchadnezzar, last time I remember. That was in Daniel chapter, all these chapters in Daniel. Wasn't that in the Old Testament? Sure was. But why is he talking about Babylon again? And so there is this idea, again, when we see something that is strange in the book of Revelation, so often what the Holy Spirit is doing is he's taking ideas from the Old Testament and he's reusing them, remolding them to be more appropriate for the needs of the Christians in the New Testament, these Christians in the first centuries. And so this is an idea. In fact, the words that he uses, look at it with me in Jeremiah chapter 51. This is going to be a passage that will be important to us in weeks to come as well. In Jeremiah 51, there is a passage here where Jeremiah is a prophet who witnesses the destruction of Jerusalem. He is in Jerusalem, and he watches as the Babylonians come and walk all over the temple. And so in Jeremiah 51, however, there is a message that is against Babylon. It says, chapter 51, verse 1, "Thus says Yahweh, behold, I am going to arouse against Babylon and against the inhabitants of Leb Kamai, the spirit of the destroyer." And so what follows is this oracle against Babylon. Notice in verse 6 now, in verse 6 especially, he says, "Flee from the midst of Babylon, and each of you escape with his life. Do not be silenced in her iniquity, for this is Yahweh's time for vengeance. He is going to render recompense to her Babylon is has been a golden cup in the hand of Yahweh, intoxicating all the earth. The nations have drunk of her wine. Therefore, the nations are going mad. Suddenly, Babylon has fallen and been broken. Wail over her. Take balm for her pains. Perhaps she may be healed. And so it continues to talk about the destruction of Babylon and these poetic ways to talk about how Babylon has been so wicked. Babylon has dealt out pain and dealt out sin to all of these different nations. And now this same cup that she has offered to all these different nations, now it comes back upon her, comes back upon Babylon. Well, in the same way, here is this nation of Rome. This nation of Rome that has been the dominating force during this time, has been the strong force, just like Babylon in the Old Testament. But now these enemies of God, these enemies of God's people, are going to find and experience the same things that they did in the Old Testament. All that to say is that Babylon, in many occasions, even in the Old Testament, is used to talk more than just about Babylon. It's about the enemies of God, is this idea of the enemies of God. So when we talk of Babylon in the book of Revelation, we ought not to think that it's coming back into power, literally. But this is talking about then the government of Rome still. But here in Revelation, going back to Revelation chapter 14, Revelation chapter 14, the note here is, Fallen is the great Babylon, who has made all the nations drink the wine of the wrath of her sexual immorality. Rome has caused all sorts of perversions, has caused all sorts of damage, and now she is going to have to drink of the same things. Keep a hold on these ideas, because we're going to come back to these ideas in chapter 17 and chapter 18, where there's this great lament over the fallen city of Babylon. Verse 9. In verse 9, there is another angel, a third one, followed by them, saying it with a loud voice, "If anyone worships the beast and his image and receives a mark on his forehead or on his hand, then he will also drink of the wine of the wrath of God, which is mixed in full strength in the cup of his rage. And he will be tormented with fire and brimstone in the presence of the holy angels and in the presence of the Lamb. And the smoke of their torment will go up forever and ever, and they will have no rest day or night, and those who worship the beast and his image, and whoever receives the mark of his name." Here is the perseverance of the saints who keep the commandments of God and their faith in Jesus Christ. "I heard the voice from heaven saying, 'Write, blessed are the dead who die in the Lord from now on.' Yes, says the Spirit, so that they may rest from their labors, for their deeds follow with them." So in verse 9, we have again this warning. He's been warning in chapter 13 already, this mark of the beast, worshiping the beast, something you don't want to do. Don't do it. You can see how it's going to be a temptation, because everybody's pressuring everybody else. No, you got to go along with this. You got to go along with this. This is what everybody's doing. And if you don't, you're going to die. But now God comes along and says, you must fear God rather than men. You have to give your only worship to God. You can imagine how difficult this statement would be, however. He says also in verse 12 that this is the perseverance of the saints who keep the commandments of God and their faith in Jesus. So he says, if you want to survive all of this, what do you have to do? Be strong. Don't take on the mark of the beast. Don't worship the beast. And you will persevere. You will outlast. But you can imagine, again, how difficult this statement will be. Because what are happening to the Christians? It doesn't look like perseverance. It doesn't look like we're being saved when right and left my brothers and sisters are dying. That's a hard statement. And so he comes back in verse 13 with a statement of blessed are the dead who die in the Lord from now on. Death is not going to be just the end of the road, but rather a stepping stone for Christians into a new life as they stand before the Lamb. Blessed are those who die in the Lord, so that they may rest from their labors, for their deeds will follow them. So you have in verse 6 an angel, verse 8 one angel announcing the gospel, verse 8 another angel announcing the great fall of Babylon, verse 9 through 11 another angel who's announcing that don't fall down to this this great beast. But now in verse 14, here comes the harvest of God. In verses 14 through 20, we have a harvest of God. Notice what it says in verse 14. He says, "Then I looked, behold, a white cloud, and sitting on the white cloud was one like a son of man, having a golden crown on his head and a sharp sickle in his hand. And another angel came out of the sanctuary, crying out with a loud voice to him who sits on the cloud, 'Put in your sickle and reap, for the hour to reap has come, because the harvest of the earth is ripe.' Then he who sits on the cloud swung his sickle over the earth, and the earth was reaped. And another angel came out of the sanctuary, which is in heaven, and he also had a sharp sickle. Then another angel, one who has authority over fire, came out from the altar, and he called with a loud voice to him who had the sharp sickle, saying, 'Put in your sharp sickle and gather the clusters of the vines of the earth, because her grapes are ripe.' So the angel swung his sickle to the earth and gathered the clusters from the vines of the earth and threw them into the great winepress of the wrath of God. And the winepress was trodden outside the city, and blood came out of the winepress up to the horses' bridles for a distance of 1,600 stadia." So you have in this picture, in verses 14 to verse 20, what looks to be a description of two different harvests. One has one who looks to be like the Son of Man. It's a description that's reminiscent of Jesus himself as the Son of Man who's riding upon a cloud. It definitely reminds us of Daniel chapter 7 and the description that we have of the Son of Man there. But the first harvest we have there. Then we have a second harvest starting in verse 17, where an angel puts forth his sickle to gather grapes into the wine press. However, the grapes are then pressed, and there's this extreme quantity of blood that comes out of the wine press. Just a real quick clarification. Sickle is not a word that we use very often here in Philly. I don't think we use it very often even in other places in the United States either. But a sickle is going to be an instrument used for the harvest. It's going to have there's a lot of different shapes for sickles. And I used to think that sickles, you don't use a sickle to harvest grapes. Well, there's other types of sickles. A sickle is going to be like, not a popsicle, but a sickle is like a curved blade. It goes around like this. And so as you pull, you kind of twist it, and that kind of cuts then whatever you're cutting. Whether it's wheat, take the sickle and cut it. Take the sickle and cut it. But then there's other sickles that are smaller, and you would use those to even cut grapes and things like that. So you have these individuals with these sickles, and they're harvesting things. So you have two harvests, and it seems like you have these two harvests with very different outcomes. So you have a first harvest in verses 14 through 16. I wonder if the first harvest represents the Lord bringing his saints home. You have this individual who seems to have the description reminds us of Jesus himself. And so what seems to have been a violent persecution turns out to be only a door into the next world, a door into a world of grace and rest and fellowship with God. If the first being is himself, Jesus himself, with a golden crown, then I think it is significant that it is the Lord himself that does the gathering. He gathers his people home. However, the second harvest is not a pleasant harvest at all. The point of the second harvest is hard to miss. God is pouring out his wrath upon his enemies. And he's taking up these grapes, these ripe grapes, and he's going to throw them into a wine press, and he's going to trod on them, and then the blood is going to come out. And again, that's one of those very strange, and wow, it just opens up your eyes to see this graphic representation, this graphic show of violence here in the book of Revelation. But I think it is significant, or it is helpful to appreciate that even here, the language comes from the Old Testament. In fact, look with me in Isaiah chapter 63. Isaiah 63. Notice this in Isaiah 63. I wish we could take more time to look at some of the context here. But in Isaiah 63, what is going to be emphasized in Isaiah 63, verses 1 through 6, number 1, is God seeing his people without help, seeing that there is no one who can help them except he alone. And so God enters into the battle as this divine warrior. Okay, so with that description, let's read chapter 63 and verses 1 through 6. It says, "Who is this that comes from Edom with garments of glowing colors from Bozrah? This one who is majestic in his clothing, marching in greatness of his power. It is I who speak in righteousness, mighty to save. Why is your clothing red? And your garments like the one who treads on the winepress? I have trodden the wine trough alone, and from the peoples there was no man with me. I also trod on them in my anger and trampled them in my wrath. And their lifeblood is sprinkled on my garments, and I stained all my clothes. For the day of vengeance was in my heart, and my year of redemption has come. I looked, and there was no one to help. I was astonished, and there was no one to uphold. So my own arm brought salvation to me, and my wrath upheld me. And I trod down the peoples in my anger, and I made them drunk in my wrath, and I brought them down. I brought down their lifeblood to the earth." Okay. That, again, this is something just very, very graphic. You have God taking his enemies and doing what with them? Stomping on them. Throwing them into the wine press and then just stomping on them until these glorious garments are just covered in blood. This is really graphic. Why is God showing this wrath? Why is the point of all of this? Although we are surprised by the graphic nature of all of this, the point is that these are the enemies of his people. These are the enemies of his people, and his people could not save themselves. And so when God sees that they cannot save themselves, he suits up as this divine warrior, and he goes to town to destroy the enemies of his people. So he takes them and he throws them into this winepress and he stomps all over them. It is this image of just complete destruction. And the image that we need to see in all of this, yes, is the complete destruction of his enemies. And then also, what does this mean? It means the salvation that we could not reach ourselves. That's the whole point of this passage. I think that's the whole point of Revelation chapter 14 as well. In Revelation chapter 14, you have these two harvests. One harvest that brings people home. Maybe that's the correct interpretation. But the second harvest then comes down, and God sees his enemies, these who have persecuted his people, and God himself suits up as this divine warrior to crush the enemies of his people. So it's a similar story that is told here. But what is surprising here is not just that the individual, that God himself, is covered with the blood. The quantity of blood here is just astounding. It says here that the blood came out from the wine press for a distance of 16,000 stadia. Stadia is not a term that we use very often. I think in the New American Standard, it uses the word miles, 200 miles. And I don't know if that's the radius or is that the diameter of this circle. Either way, it's a lot of blood. And it's up to the horse's bridle, so we're talking maybe five. Okay, you can go home and do all the calculations you want, but that's a lot of blood. That's not just, you know, someone, just a few gallons of blood. This is like a lake, a sea of blood. What's the purpose? The purpose is not just to offend us with gory details. It's to show us how powerful God is and that God is taking care of his enemies, taking care of our enemies. God is destroying those who have destroyed his people. Finally, the vengeance that God had promised is coming upon those who have mocked him and have destroyed his people. I think this is an important point, apart from the book of Revelation, especially when we see this same image in the book of Isaiah and also here in the book of Revelation, just this idea of what God does to our enemies and how God intercedes and takes part in this battle. The battles that we wage are not battles that we wage alone. This is God's battle. And when we are faced with the devil and his henchmen, whoever they may be, I hope that when we read this, even though this is specifically talking about what God was going to do to the enemies there in the first few centuries, really doesn't matter what name we put on the henchmen that the devil uses today. God will take care of his enemies even today. I think it's helpful then to see it as well, just thinking about this on a personal level, the temptations that I go through. God will fight my battles for me if I will give myself to his power and his love. That's an important lesson for us. I'm going to go ahead and stop there for time's sake, and we'll go ahead and start with chapter 15 on another occasion. But I hope that chapter 14 kind of gets us into the right mood of seeing, okay, now we're starting this great judgment upon the enemies of God, upon the enemies of God's people. And really what we're going to do in chapter 15 and 16, okay, here's another way to look at that same story. Really, chapter 14 says, this is what God's going to do to his enemies. Done. I can tell you again, this is what God's going to do to his enemies. Chapter 15 and 16, we're done. In fact, chapter 17 and 18, this is what God is going to do to his enemies. There's a lot of repetition, in other words, in all of these chapters. But it's like this vision of, you know, when you have an instant replay from in a football game, you don't just get one angle. You get it from this angle. You get it from this angle. You get it from this angle. This is the big moment where God is destroying his enemies. And we're going to see all the angles, in other words. And so next time when we get in the book of Revelation, we're going to come back, same theme. But now in chapter 15, we're going to see God's bowls of wrath that he pours out upon his enemies. Thank you so much for your attention and your patience. God bless us all as we continue to study God's word.